am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War, picking up the story in the spring of 1951 during the Korean War, President Truman having just fired the popular General Douglas MacArthur, commander of American forces in Korea, for insubordination. By the end of May 1951, the forces led by General MacArthur's successor, General Matthew Ridgway, had pushed the North Koreans above the 38th parallel. At Washington's Statler Hotel that month, President Truman, in black tie, spoke at an Armed Forces Day banquet, which was broadcast by radio to the nation and the troops in Korea. Truman asked Americans to quit your bickering here at home. Did it ever occur to you that if this necessity with which we are faced is not met, that the casualties in Korea will be one small drop in the bucket from one of those horrible bombs of which we talk so much? Despite his dowdy personal public persona, President Truman suffered from sending so many young Americans off to die in a far-off place their families scarcely knew. Having fought in France in World War I, Truman could not easily distance himself from the images of hurt and death. He was aided by the unstinting adoration of his wife and daughter, and although he rarely spoke of it in public, his strong faith in God and constant reading of the Bible. Truman lampooned other politicians who wore their religion on their sleeves and said he liked being a Baptist because it gave a common man like him the most direct route to the Almighty. Truman could recite from the scriptures and believed that global problems could be solved if only men would follow the Beatitudes. At 67, the president was compulsive in his efforts to remain physically able to respond to the day and night demands of the war. He took regular fast walks with the Secret Service detail near the Washington Monument, surprising the tourists. He swam almost nightly, sometimes with Dr. Graham, a D-Day veteran and son of an old Missouri friend, in the indoor White House pool installed by President Franklin Roosevelt. Dr. Graham would tell him, "You're not going to be a prize fighter. Just keep in good physical condition. I will see to that." Next to the pool, the president performed calisthenics and used wall pulleys and a rowing machine, after which he had a rub down and zipped himself into a steam box with his square, perspiring head poking out of the top, talking to Dr. Graham about the problems of the war. Truman had been subject to severe headaches, sleeplessness, and nausea during times of stress when he was a county judge and a U.S. senator. His daughter Margaret recalled his tendency to ignore his illnesses. But suppressing anxiety took its toll on this emotional man who did not like to reveal his inner life. Several times while in the Senate, Truman had himself quietly hospitalized at an Army-Navy institution in Hot Springs, Arkansas, for work-related pressures. Now Dr. Graham and his wife, the First Lady, urged him to unwind whenever he could on the presidential yacht Williamsburg and at his little White House on the naval base at Key West. The public did not know that Truman suffered from a kind of congestive heart failure called cardiac asthma. When the new president took office in 1945, a Senate physician had told Dr. Graham that he didn't envy him because Truman's pulmonary obstruction was so grave that he might not live out his term as president. Truman responded to Dr. Graham's warnings in 1947 with his usual stoicism. "Doc tells me that I have cardiac asthma," he wrote in his diary. "Ain't that hell? Well, it makes no difference. We'll go on as before. I've sworn him to secrecy. So what?" As Dr. Graham later recalled, Truman would get really clutched up at night with severe coughing, rails, edema, and bubbling in the lungs, for which the doctor gave him diuretics. At Blair House, Dr. Graham would sit by the president's bedside until the attack had subsided and Truman was ready, with the sun glinting through the blinds, to face the latest news from Korea. In June 1951, Senator Joe McCarthy upped his attack. In a long speech on the Senate floor, he accused Secretary of State Dean Acheson and General George Marshall of a great conspiracy to hand the United States to communism, with Truman as their front and captive and not master in his own house. The demagogue charged that General Marshall was steeped in falsehood, a mysterious, powerful figure who had sided with the Soviets in decisions that lost the peace, part of a conspiracy of infamy so black that when it is finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men. While dedicating a new military facility in Tullahoma, Tennessee, President Truman denounced Senator McCarthy and his henchmen, stating, "They are trying to set the people against the government by spreading fear and slander and outright lies. They have tried to besmirch the loyalty of General George Marshall, who directed our strategy in winning the greatest war in history. They have deliberately tried to destroy Dean Acheson, one of the greatest Secretary of States in the history of this country. It's playing right into the hands of the Russians. They want us to play Russian roulette with the foreign policy of the United States, with all the chambers of the pistols loaded." In June, the Soviets proposed a Korean ceasefire and withdrawal of both sides to the 38th parallel, dividing the two countries. They had dropped their earlier demands that all foreign troops depart Korea and that Formosa, now Taiwan, seat on the UN Security Council be given to Mao's China. In response, Senator Joe McCarthy forecast the planned betrayal of 1951, which would constitute the death warrant of every American boy who has died in Korea. The Gallup poll found that Americans would favor a Korean truce at the 38th parallel by 51% to 37%. Truman told aides he was not too optimistic, but asked General Ridgway to pursue the possibility. China consented, and the talks began in July at the North Korean town of Kaesong near the 38th parallel. The president wrote his wife, Bess, that Korea was likely to be followed by another local war, stating, "We are not sure when the next outbreak will come. It can be Indochina, Burma, Iraq, West Germany, or Nepal, and it will be one of them, I'm sure." The Korea talks, which were later shifted to a tent in Panmunjom, were stalemated when the North demanded that roughly 132,000 North Korean prisoners of war be returned to its untender mercies. Truman vowed, "We will not buy an armistice by turning over human beings for slaughter or slavery." He glimmered over his inability to break the deadlock. Scrawling into his diary in January 1952, Truman fantasized about confronting the Soviet Union and China directly, stating, "Dealing with communist governments is like an honest man trying to deal with numbers racket king or the head of a dope ring. It now looks as if all the Chinese wanted when they asked for a ceasefire was a chance to import war materials and resupply their front lines. It seems to me that the proper approach now would be an ultimatum with a 10-day expiration limit, informing Moscow that we intend to blockade the China coast from the Korean border to Indochina, and that we intend to destroy every military base in Manchuria, including submarine bases. And if there is further interference, we shall eliminate any port or cities necessary to accomplish our peaceful purpose. That this situation can be avoided by the withdrawal of all Chinese troops from Korea and the stoppage of all supplies of war materials by Russia to Communist China, we of the free world have suffered long enough. This means all-out war. This is the final chance for the Soviet government to decide whether it decides to survive or not." Truman had been tempted to pursue another term in office as a means of vindicating himself over Korea, but his wife, Bess, told him she thought he couldn't survive another 4 years as president. During a Key West vacation in November 1951, he called his closest aides to the poker table on his porch and told them in strict confidence that he would not run for re-election. To prove that he was not pulling out to avoid a defeat at the polls over Korea, he showed them an April 1950 entry from his diary in which he had vowed not to run again, writing, "There is a lure in power. It can get into a man's blood just as gambling and lust for money has been known to do." To succeed him, Truman wanted his close friend, Chief Justice Fred Vinson, an ex-congressman from Kentucky, who had served as a Secretary of Treasury. He once told his wife, Bess, that Justice Vinson believes in me, trusts me, and supports me. In the more casual tradition of those days, Truman often talked politics with the Chief Justice, including cases that the Supreme Court was about to consider. Vinson was a member of the President's poker group on the yacht Williamsburg, and the First Lady and his daughter Margaret called him Papa Vin. The Chief Justice, however, refused his friend's offer. He felt that the court should not be used as a stepping stone to the presidency, and his own wife was worried about his health. Truman then turned to Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois, whom he scarcely knew. He respected Stevenson's probity, eloquence, and decency, and remembered from his childhood when Adlai's namesake grandfather was Grover Cleveland's vice president. One evening in January 1952, Truman ushered the governor into a study at Blair House, where they sat before a fire. He told Stevenson that he had been reading the Bible and had done so all his life. Startled by the president's offer to support him, Stevenson explained that he had committed himself to run for re-election in Illinois. He felt that Truman must have thought him a complete idiot. He privately told James Rustin of the New York Times newspaper that should Eisenhower be the Republican nominee, he did not deem it my duty to save Western civilization from the World War II hero. Truman invited Governor Stevenson for another talk, but the governor again demurred. In March, the president was defeated in the New Hampshire Democratic primary by the calculating homespun Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, a Yale Law graduate who campaigned in a coonskin cap. Truman disdained Kefauver as intellectually dishonest and ignorant of American history. Truman's dander up, he now considered entering the race. Although against the idea, his wife Bess and daughter Margaret told him he was the only Democrat who could win the presidency in 1952. Truman asked his diary, "What the hell am I to do?" To discuss another campaign, he gathered his loyalists, including Fred Vinson, but they politely argued him to retire for his health. Truman's aide Charlie Murphy privately felt that the administration was going to cede and the country needed new blood. Eager to avoid the appearance that his unpopularity over Korea had driven him out of the race, Truman told the press that the war would have no bearing whatever on what I may decide to do. On Saturday night, March 29, 1952, during a black-tied Jefferson-Jackson banquet of Democrats at the D.C. Armory, Truman defended his conduct of the war. He noted that some Republicans seemed to think it would be popular to pull out of Korea, and others wished to expand the fighting and stop dropping atomic bombs. If that happened, and God forbid that it comes, such loud talkers would be the first people to run for the bomb shelters. At the end of his speech, he surprised the audience, stating, "I have served my country long, and I think efficiently and honestly I shall not accept a renomination." Truman has sprung his news so abruptly that some listeners clapped without realizing what they were doing. Governor Stevenson, who was present, noticed that some of his fellow Democrats were applauding. Truman's withdrawal was really Maccabee enthusiasm. 10 days later, the lame duck Truman staged a breathtaking assertion of presidential power, issuing an executive order for the federal government to seize American steel companies. Management and labor had been unable to reach a new contract, and the Steel Workers Union was threatening a strike. Truman was advised that a work stoppage could block the steel supply for weapons going to Korea. He believed that a president has very great inherent powers to meet great national emergencies, and that it was his duty under the Constitution to act to preserve the safety of the nation. On Tuesday night, April 8th, Truman went on television to charge that industry leaders were recklessly forcing a shutdown of the steel mills. "He would not be living up to my oath of office," he stated, "if he did not provide U.S. soldiers in Korea with munitions required for their survival, so at midnight, the government will take over the steel plants. Truman later told Roger Tubby, "My heart was in it, Jesus." As Truman noted in his diary, the president was clearly played out. Truman himself confessed that he was terribly tired. After he gave the speech, his press secretary, Joseph Short, feared that his chief would collapse. The president was widely excoriated for the steel seizure. New York's Daily News newspaper claimed Hitler and Mussolini would have loved this. Senator Lyndon Johnson publicly warned that Truman's decision smacks of the practices that lead toward a dictatorship. Other members of Congress filed 14 separate bills of impeachment against Truman. Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, campaigning for a president in the Massachusetts Republican primary, agreed that the House of Representatives had a valid case for forcing Truman into a Senate trial, stating, "He might just as well go a step farther and draft the steelworkers into the Army without the consent of Congress." Republican Congressman George Bender of Ohio warned that the president might go on to seize the nation's broadcast and newspaper companies as well. Defending himself, Truman told reporters that the steel strike posed as great an emergency as we have ever faced, stating, "I have tried to meet it. I've been abused roundly for it. I am not the first president that has been abused under these same circumstances, so I know how to take it." He recounted that earlier presidents have had to make decisions in emergencies, and it made the republic better. With his Louisiana purchase, Jefferson had paid $15 million for the greatest addition to this country that has ever been made, and they tried to impeach him for that. Truman went on to praise President Tyler's annexation of Texas in the 19th century and President Polk's aggressiveness against Mexico, as well as the bold actions by Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt in wartime. Hidden from the public for decades was that in the planning of steel seizure, Truman had grossly violated the constitutional separation of powers. Before taking this audacious action, he had secretly confided his plan to Chief Justice Vinson, asking the Chief Justice whether the Supreme Court would uphold it. Vinson had told him not to worry, and the president had gone ahead. The steel companies responded to the seizure by suing the federal government, and U.S. District Court Judge David Pine issued an injunction. On June 2nd, the Supreme Court found Truman's action unconstitutional by a vote of 6-3. Speaking for the majority, Justice Robert Jackson wrote that no doctrine could be more sinister and alarming than the notion that some future president might be encouraged to send U.S. armed forces into some foreign venture in order to expand his personal power over domestic affairs. Shocked by the court's ruling, Truman privately called it crazy. In a letter which he did not send, he angrily wrote Justice William O. Douglas, stating, "I don't see how a court made up of so-called liberals could do what that court did to me. I'm going to find out just why before I quit this office." On Monday, July 7, 1952, the Republican Convention opened in Chicago. The keynote speaker was General Douglas MacArthur, who, wearing a double-breasted suit, looked his full 72 years. He charged that Truman had lacked the courage to fight to a military decision in Korea, although victory was then readily within our grasp. MacArthur privately hoped that he might be anointed as a presidential nominee after a deadlock between the two front runners, Eisenhower and Taft. But by then the air had gone out of his national balloon. Truman chortled in a letter to his wife Bess that General MacArthur was a complete flop as a keynoter. After an intense struggle, Ike took the nomination and chose Richard Nixon as his running mate. As the president watched the Republicans on television with their anti-Truman harangues, Dr. Graham, his physician, noted that his chief was showing breathing trouble, abdominal pain, and general malaise. The following Sunday at noon, Truman convened his political advisors, including Vice President Alvin Barkley. As Truman later wrote in his diary, stating, "We agreed that we would support Barkley for the nomination since Stevenson could not make up his mind." Everyone present knew that the garrulous, ailing 74-year-old Veep was unlikely to defeat Eisenhower. Truman now realized that he would probably be succeeded in office by a Republican who might try to overturn much of what he had achieved. After his guest departed, the president tottered and almost fell to the floor. Dr. Graham found that his patient was beet-faced, extremely nervous, and had a shaking chill with hot and fairly moist skin and a fever of almost 104 degrees. Truman told his doctor that he wished to return to his desk, but his wife Bess took command by telephone from Independence, Missouri, and had him removed to Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. There, Truman slept almost uninterrupted for 48 hours, not far from wounded soldiers back from Korea. The Democrats met in Chicago a week later, in the summer of 1952. Stevenson called the president at the White House to ask whether it would embarrass him should he let his name be placed in contention. Although irritated by the governor's dawdling, Truman promised support. Stevenson won the prize and chose Senator John Sparkman of Alabama for his ticket. On the final night of the convention, the president told the delegates, "We have met aggression in Korea, and we have stopped it there." He promised to take my coat off and do everything I can to help Stevenson win. When the nominee spoke, however, Stevenson did not even mention the stalemated Korean War. Distancing himself from Truman, Stevenson located his headquarters not in Washington, but in Springfield, Illinois, writing a friend, "The line to emphasize is that I am not Truman's candidate." Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., who took leave from Harvard that fall to write speeches for Stevenson, thought that the nominee regarded Truman as a kind of old man of the sea clinging to his shoulders. Eisenhower ran against communism, corruption in Korea, as well as what he called the mess in Washington. Asked by the Oregon Journal newspaper whether Eisenhower could clean up that mess, Stevenson cited his record in Illinois. The president was furious over Stevenson's tacit admission that Truman had created a mess, as well as Sparkman's comment that Truman had mishandled the steel workers' strike. The president told his friend Tubby that they are running against me, not against Ike, and can't win that way. Adlai Stevenson's patrician background and Princeton education triggered Truman's class consciousness. In a letter he failed to send, Truman wrote Stevenson that he seemed to be embarrassed by and above associating with the lowly President of the United States, adding, "I can't stand snub after snub by you." In another unsent letter to Stevenson, Truman objected to the candidate's public claim that he was indebted to no one for his nomination, stating, "That makes nice reading in the sabotage press, but gets you no votes because it isn't true. I'm telling you to take your crackpots, your high socialites with their noses in the air, run your campaign, and win if you can." Nevertheless, Truman barnstormed for Stevenson by train, telling crowds, stating, "Never let anyone tell you that the Korean episode has been a useless one, for there we have stopped the communists. We have upset their timetable, and we have pushed them back, and we have surely saved the world from total war." Eisenhower postponed making a major speech on the war until the last fortnight of the race. At Detroit's Masonic Temple, in a national TV broadcast, Eisenhower called Korea the burial ground for 20,000 American dead and a damning measure of the quality of leadership we have ever been given. Eisenhower derided Truman for having encouraged the war by pulling American forces from Korea and allowing Dean Acheson to rule it outside the nation's defense perimeter. In the most remembered line of his campaign, Eisenhower pledged, "I shall go to Korea." Then, unfettered by past decisions and inherited mistakes, Eisenhower could review every factor, military, political, and psychological, to be mobilized in speeding up a just peace. Fighting back, Truman released a statement recalling that Eisenhower had endorsed his earlier Korean withdrawal of the late 1940s. Privately, Truman complained that if Ike knew how to end the war immediately, he should save American lives by sharing his secret blueprint with the president right now. Eisenhower's promise that, unlike the Democrats, he could break the Korean deadlock ensured his landslide victory over Stevenson by 55 to 44% of the popular vote. Congratulating Eisenhower by telegram. Truman told him that if he still desired to go to Korea, he would lend him the presidential airplane Independence. Offended by what he saw as Truman's insinuation that his Korea pledge had been a campaign ploy that might now be dropped, Eisenhower refused the offer, and in late November 1952, boarded an Air Force Constellation to fly from Long Island to Seoul, Korea. "I sincerely wish he didn't have to make the trip," Truman wrote in his diary. "It is an awful risk. May God protect him." Touring the Korean battlefront, wearing a fur-lined parka and cap, Eisenhower debriefed soldiers and concluded that letting the Korean stalemate continue would be intolerable. In a December 1952 press conference, Truman deepened his feud with Eisenhower. When asked about a report that Truman had been privately urged to bolster Stevenson during the campaign by announcing that he would visit Korea, confirming the story, the president tartly said he had been decided that flying to Korea would be just a piece of demagoguery, and that is what it turned out to be. Asked if he meant that Eisenhower's tour in Korea, Truman said, "Yes, the announcement of that trip was a piece of demagoguery, and then, of course, he had to take it after he made the statement." His friend Roger Tubby whispered caution into his ear. Truman told the reporters, "Well, Roger suggested that maybe some good might come out of the trip. If it does, I'll be the happiest man in the world." Reading from Michael Beschloss's essay on Harry Truman and the Korean War will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.